Hello, and welcome to the Wellness Mama podcast. I'm Katie from wellnessmama.com, and this episode is about the biggest blockers of blood sugar regulation and how this relates to chronic disease. And I'm here with Katrina Foe, who became a practitioner after her own breast cancer diagnosis and getting it into remission 100% naturally. And she's now on a mission to help many other people avoid and recover as well. She's board certified in holistic nutrition, and she's been in the health field since she opened her studio at the age of 24. She is a homeschool mom of seven, and she wrote a international bestseller called Nutritional Pilates, Relieve Joint Pain, Lose Unwanted Weight, and Prevent Chronic Disease to Become Your Most Vibrant Self. So without further ado, let's learn from Katrina on how to best regulate our blood sugar. Katrina, welcome back. Thanks for being here again.
Oh, great to be here.
Well, we had such a fun conversation on the root causes and the root drivers of cancer in our first episode, which I will make sure is linked in the show notes. If you guys haven't listened, it's phenomenal. And in this one, I want to go deep on another topic that I think actually sort of universally applies, especially in today's world, which is the topic of blood sugar regulation and specifically the things that we might be doing that are blocking a healthy metabolic response and healthy insulin glucose responses that we might not even be aware of. So to start broad, can you introduce why this topic is so important in the first place?
Oh, yeah, it is so important. The blood sugar, to me, has a very special place in my heart because I had my own cancer diagnosis. And what I learned through that process and diving into the research and eventually becoming a practitioner is that blood sugar dysregulation is the root of all chronic disease. So when we're talking about, you know, the big ones, the scary ones that people talk about, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, Alzheimer's, those are going to be rooted in blood sugar dysregulation. And the thing is, we can see this coming. We can test and we can look for it. But the problem is that, one, people don't realize that it is connected. People are looking at, you know, cholesterol markers and such and thinking that's going to do it. And then two, they don't feel that it's an issue for them because they feel fine. I hear this all the time. No, I don't have an issue with that. I feel fine. I'm like, okay, well, let's look at the labs because the labs are not going to lie in terms of blood sugar regulation. And that's when we see things really come out of the woodwork. And, you know, for me, my dad has Alzheimer's. He is in a memory care facility. And it just breaks my heart to know that if I had known then, you know, like 20 years ago, what I know now, maybe he wouldn't be there. And I wish for everyone out there that, you know, we can do something and we can have better. Those tools are very easy to, you know, get a hold of now with the information and the tools that we have. But it takes some intentionality.
And I know I've seen varying statistics, but the most recent one I saw was upwards of 90% have at least people have at least one marker of some sort of metabolic dysfunction. So this is a huge widespread problem, no matter which statistic you go with, because they're all well above 50% of the population. And we all see those stats rising every year on all the metabolic issues that people are facing and the rise of things like diabetes and prediabetes and all of these chronic health conditions. But like we touched on in our first episode, the good news here is that when we're talking about metabolic conditions that are lifestyle related, we actually have the ability to shift a lot of this. And like you mentioned, especially with technology now, while there could be some downsides to that, one of these tremendous upsides is the access to data that we didn't used to have, at least without extensive lab testing or having to go somewhere. So with the tools that are now available, what can we look at? What can we monitor? And what are we trying to pay attention to make sure we're in a good range?
Oh, yes. So most people, when they're thinking about blood sugar, they're looking at the glucose numbers in their blood. So doctors, when they run panels, they'll run two panels usually, a CBC, comprehensive blood, and then they will look at a metabolic panel. And the glucose is in that metabolic panel, and that is probably the least helpful number because you're taking it out of fasting state first thing in the morning, which in my opinion is really more looking at how your adrenals are functioning. It's not a really great indicator of your blood sugar. So what you want to look at, and this means you need to intercede and like speak up and tell your doctor what you want. You want to look at the hemoglobin A1C. That's one of my very favorite markers. That's going to give you like a 3-month average look at your blood sugar. So is it spiking all the time? That's what you're looking at. I also want to look at the insulin. So the insulin levels, you know, if you have high insulin early in the morning, like why in the world would it be high? You haven't eaten for forever. There's going to be something that is wrong there, and that should be a big red flag. And again, seeing both of them is really nice. I also want to see the LDH, so the lactate dehydrogenase, and that, if it's low, is going to be an indicator that there's probably some hypoglycemia. Now, honestly, between you and me, like a lot of clients can tell if they have any hypoglycemia from symptoms. So they're shaky, hangry, but if they don't eat enough, you know, they need to have their meals closer together, all that kind of stuff. But here you can see it, because what I find is sometimes clients kind of instinctively eat every 2 or 3 hours because they kind of know that that feels better. And so they're not having those symptoms because they're not getting to that place. But I can see on the labs, oh, there's an issue there. Now, on the other end, the LDH, when it's really high, I'm looking at that with my cancer clients because that usually skyrockets in terms of inflammation. And I actually use that as a marker to monitor things. So it's kind of got this dual purpose. So those are some of the blood work that you would go get from your doctor. But also, you can do a lot of things at home, which is so exciting. You can get what's called continuous glucose monitors, or you can do the finger pricks with like a Keto Mojo, the glucometer. I like the Keto Mojo because it's got ketones and the glucose if you're really trying to dial things in. But you can get a simple glucometer at a drugstore for like under $20. This is not an expensive item. And what I recommend with clients is to look at lots of different things. So there's not like one right way to do it. Most people are like, okay, I'm going to do it first thing in the morning like the lab does. Again, that's not what I'm looking at. I want to do kind of a baseline test with clients first, not with the glucose that they do in the lab for glucose tolerance tests, because that is toxic and disgusting and nobody should be eating that anyways. I want to see a sample meal. So I have my clients write down a sample meal, nice balance, whatever is a typical carb load for them. They test their blood sugar beforehand. They test it, you know, after the meal, like half an hour to an hour, and then continually until the numbers go down. So what we're looking at here is how high does it go and how long does it stay high? And that's going to give you some really great metrics and understanding of what your body is doing. And then I make them remember what that meal is, because that's going to be their test. As they do some work, they can go back like a couple months later, not days, and look and see, oh, look at the progress I've made. It doesn't go as high. It gets back to normal quicker. I've made progress. So that's one way of using it. The other thing is to start problem solving. So looking at what is throwing you out of ketosis, what is making your blood sugar go high? And there's not like a rhyme or reason as to when you test, but I have found some very interesting things. So for myself, I got really excited. The local pizza place started carrying cauliflower pizza crust. Like this was a while ago. And I'm like, yay, I can finally have a date night and go to a restaurant or something to eat. And I had a monitor on and I went up to like 170. And I don't usually go past 100. So I'm like, oh my goodness. So clearly this was not a ketogenic cauliflower pizza crust. It was a disaster. For example, I've had clients that have figured out that one lady had red bell peppers. Again, not a bad food, super healthy, not a high carb food. But every time she ate them, she had some kind of a food sensitivity that made her blood sugar go crazy. And again, you wouldn't know this unless you test it. And then the most common thing that I see with clients is stress. So one of the things that will really throw off the blood sugar if you have some kind of stress. So, okay, if I have a fight with my daughter, husband's business partner, whatever, look at the blood sugar, because a lot of times you'll be surprised at how crazy high it will go from the stress levels. And, you know, so dialing in those and identifying them for yourself is a really great way to use those.
I love that. And I love that you differentiate between that morning fasting glucose and throughout the day and what the actual response to food is. I do think that morning one can be great to let you know if you've got some cortisol stuff going on. But as you said, that's not going to be your most accurate if you're focusing on the glucose side. Though I have noticed as I addressed inflammation in my body and got my blood sugar very regulated, I now have a very steady fasting glucose between 75 and 80. But it was a journey to get there. And I also have a healthy response after food. I also think for anybody who hasn't tested this before, I always like to speak to, you might also see a glucose response from exercise or from sauna, and those aren't necessarily bad. In fact, those can be really healthy and good. And maybe you have even more insight on that, but I just always like to tell people, don't panic if your glucose rises when you're working out or when you get in the sauna. That's actually a metabolic thing happening that's positive. Are there any other things that are blocking that healing response? And then I want to also touch on inflammation in a minute. But I love that you brought up stress, because I think that one is often overlooked. Like, you could be doing everything, quote unquote, right. And if stress is a huge underlying factor, your body is going to be in a state of stress, and it's going to reflect that.
Oh, yes. I'm so glad that you brought up the exercise and saunas, because those can be really confusing things for people, especially when, you know, I'm telling them to do a sauna and they're like, it's screwing me up every time. And it's like, no, that's okay. Yeah. With the cortisol response that you're talking about overnight, that is really important to understand that all those hormones, whether it's insulin, cortisol, we're talking about sex hormones, thyroid hormones, we like to compartmentalize them and put them in separate little boxes. And they don't really do that in our body. They all interact and discuss things and work together. So that's just a really great example of what's happening there, where if your adrenals are, we'll just say, dysregulated, that is going to affect your blood sugar and vice versa. They're all intertwined. The other big thing that I see that is probably one of the biggest frustrations for my clients is the mold. So when clients have mold issues, mold toxicity, high levels in their body, this will screw everything up hormonally. And what I see is the client is doing everything right. They are eating like super dialed in, and they've got their stress levels down. They're, you know, everything is perfect, so to speak. And they cannot get into ketosis to save their life. It's not them. And I hear so often people will come and they're like, yeah, I tried ketogenic diet, it didn't work. You know, I'm like, okay, no, this is not that it doesn't work. This is not it's that you haven't dialed it in for you. So one of the biggest things is looking at the mold. And okay, so I work with cancer clients. And I'm just going to tell you, between you and I test every single client for mold. I have only had one client ever that didn't have toxic levels of mold. Like, that's how big of a driver it is for cancer. And again, so I see this connection because I'm working with all of them to get into a ketogenic state and how often it will block the blood sugar, but it doesn't do it every time. So this is one of those things to kind of dial in. But once we get the mold addressed, the blood sugar does happy things and will go back into place. So I just like to emphasize that it may not be you. You may not be crazy. You may be doing all the right things, and there's still other things going on there.
Are there like optimal ranges on some of these, especially the at-home tests, that people can strive for, like sort of target goals that they're aiming for as they work on this?
In terms of the blood sugar?
Yeah, blood sugar and or I know we talked about ketones in the first podcast about the cancer side. Are there kind of targets that are an ideal range that we're aiming for?
Absolutely. So blood sugar, so the glucose levels, whether you're looking at your lab ranges from the first morning fasted or if you're looking during the day, ideally you want to keep it between 70 and 90. Now, if you've just eaten, it will go up. And the more metabolically flexible you are, the less that's going to happen. The more you're eating low carb, the less that's going to happen. So ideally, if someone's eating low carb, you know, it's not going above like 100 even if they're metabolically flexible. But you will see a rise, and you know, that's not a bad thing necessarily. Now, the hemoglobin A1C I'm looking at, I want it to be like under 5-ish. Ideally, the lab ranges are very different. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the fact that the lab ranges are an average of whoever is taking the test local to you. So I work with clients all over the country, and you know, somebody's labs in Alabama are going to have different lab ranges than in Seattle. It's very weird. So we want to have a standard of what is, you know, acceptable. Now, the actual ketones, we want those to be in a nutritional state, which is about 0.5 to 2. Now, some people say 0.7, it's up for debate, but you want to get into the kind of like 1 point this or that range, ideally, to really be in a good consistent ketosis. Now, if you're not dealing with a chronic health issue, cycling out and in is a great way to really improve metabolic flexibility. you know, if you're dealing like I am with my clients in a therapeutic state, they need to get in there and stay there and even get further into what we call therapeutic ketosis. So that's going to be higher, you know, so 3, 4. And like you mentioned before, you know, with a water fast, getting into like 6, 7, totally acceptable. And it actually feels really good when you're deep into it because your brain lights up in a whole nother way because it thrives on those ketones. So those are just some numbers to look at if you're looking at home at what you should, your numbers should be.
And in the first episode, we talked about sort of the environmental triggers and the things that can sort of like create that stress in the body that can also block healing. And I would guess with blood sugar regulation, you've touched on this as well, that that can be a factor. We mentioned stress specifically, and of course, other things in our environment as well. But are there any things that we can do to help the body detox and to address that inflammation side? Because certainly in all of these podcasts, everything I've covered relating to chronic health conditions, inflammation is a recurring topic and definitely a seemingly huge one in today's world.
Yes, it is. That's kind of like the basis of everything. And that's why I use the inflammation markers. So like the high sensitivity CRP, the SED rate, and that LDH to monitor cancer. And those are all inflammation markers. So with inflammation, I'm just going to state the obvious, and I'm sure your listeners are already well-versed in this, but you want to get the inflammatory foods out first. And this is, I say the obvious, but a lot of people want to skip to like, what's a supplement I take? And you've got to get, you know, your diet as a foundation first. So absolutely none of those rancid, toxic vegetable oils and such, nowhere near. And I just can't stress enough, like if you are going out to dinner at a restaurant, you are eating those oils, like unless you're crazy intentional about it, because that's what they're going to use. That's economical. That's a good business model because they're cheap. So watching out for those and being aggressive, I tell my clients, take your salad dressing with you. Also, making sure that the blood sugar is regulated. We've been talking about this, you know, in this episode, but that is going to be a major driver of inflammation. And so getting the diet dialed in with those two big factors makes an enormous difference. And then, of course, adding nutrient density with, you know, anti-inflammatory foods can be fabulous. And making sure you got the processed junk out will also help. But diet first, always, always.
And I know I've noticed when I'm wearing a glucose monitor specifically, if I get even one night of poor sleep, my glucose is less regulated the next day. And I know that I've even heard kind of extreme versions of that, that a few nights of disrupted sleep can put you in the ranges of a pre-diabetic. And so it seems like sleep, and you talked about all the hormones being interrelated. It seems like sleep would be a big factor here as well. Do you find that even in testing with people, is sleep a big factor that we need to address, and any tips along those lines?
Yeah, sleep is a huge factor. And everybody's a little different in how much it affects them. I feel like sleep is actually my superpower. That's what I like do best. That's my saving grace. But for a lot of my clients, the sleep thing, it can really throw you off, especially if you're, you know, if you have little kids that are waking you up, nursing moms and such. It's a really uphill battle to get that good night's sleep. And you want to give yourself grace and know that that is working against you, possibly for the inflammation and the blood sugar. And keep that in mind as you're trying to create your plan of like, that's important. That's the big rock you got to get in first. But the sleep is definitely, it's going to be messing with that adrenal circadian rhythm big time. And like I said, all those hormones are so intertwined with it. For me, the sleep is a really big thing because that's also when we do a lot of our detoxification, whether it's the lymphatic system in our brain or other areas to really do the healing work. We want to have those other areas like digestion stuff have a break so that your body can do the work it's supposed to. So if you're not getting enough actual sleep, the detoxification isn't happening. And keep in mind that a lot of those toxins, you know, need to get out. And if we want to reduce the inflammation. And so, you know, there's all these different ways to tie it in together. So as best you can, I know it's overwhelming to think of all of these things, you know, picking the battles of where you can start with something that you can actually make a difference on is always a good thing.
Agreed. And one step at a time that becomes a habit and then build from there is, I feel like, an easier path than trying to just do everything perfectly overnight. But yeah, I'm glad that we got to talk about sleep. I feel like that's a big one. And when I was in recovery from Hashimoto's, I was very gentle with myself and slept a lot, was like did gentle movement only. I was not doing high intensity anything. I was letting my body have time to heal. And then I reintroduced those things gradually as I knew that my body could handle it. So I think that's super important as well. Are there any other tips related to supplements or lifestyle factors that people can do, especially to support their liver, or anything that you find is often very helpful? You mentioned coffee enemas briefly in our other episode, but anything that's supportive sort of externally that people can also research and consider?
Absolutely. There's so much amazing low-hanging fruit that we can do as moms just at home. I'm hesitant to recommend certain supplements because it's so bio-individual of what people need. And a lot of times, yeah, there can be stuff that generally is good for some people, but isn't always effective. And I think we need to be good stewards of our time and our money a lot of times and get the specifics. So that would be dialed in a lot of times with actual testing. But the one thing that I find that most people need, especially if they're pregnant or nursing, is stomach acid. And this is not the sexy thing. People tend to dismiss it, and it doesn't make rainbows shoot out your ears. But it's going to be kind of the base to make sure that you are digesting your food properly. So if you're spending a ton of money and looking at that food budget, you know, on healthy, good, nutritious food, and you're doing all these cool things to prepare it the most healthful way possible, like, it's kind of offensive if you're not getting all the nutrition out of it. So I tell people, like, this is the first place you need to look. It's the highest up on the hierarchy of digestion. And it's the first thing to go when you're pregnant. So for me, I found when I was pregnant, I needed the max dosage. So basically, I was making like no stomach acid at all. And then I kind of was doing better. And then I remember my last one, after I had her, I thought I was going to eat my husband. Like, I was so hungry and nothing satiated me. And I was like, oh, shoot, maybe I should check my stomach acid levels again. And oh my gosh. As soon as I got that dialed in, it was night and day. So I always encourage pregnant nursing moms to look at that, but also those that are under stress, because stress will deplete your stomach acid levels. So I'll actually give you a handout on it if you want. You want to start with a very, very low dose of hydrochloric acid. Always take it with meals. So if you do intermittent fasting and you skip a meal, like, don't double up on it. And you just gradually titrate up till you feel like you might be getting the beginnings of heartburn. And that means that's time to stop. And that's where your dosage is. And I mean, I work with extreme chronic, you know, cancer cases, and they need the highest dose, but not everyone does. And so you want to find your spot and know that as you have, like, you know, even if it's good stress, like a wedding in the family, you know, those needs will shift and ebb and flow. So having your finger on that can be really helpful. In terms of coffee enemas, those are one of my very favorite topics. So I'm so glad you brought that up. Infrared saunas are awesome. They're my favorite for detox, but that's a big investment. And if people don't have a big health condition, that may not be where they want to go right now. But the coffee enemas are so cheap. And the price of the nice stainless steel bucket has come down insane. I mean, I remember when I got mine, it was like $80, and they're like $20 or $30 now. So get a stainless steel one. Get some mold-free coffee, like pure or something. Again, no affiliates. I'm just letting you know. You want to look for mold-free because you don't want to add toxins in while you're trying to take them out. And depending on your health conditions, those can be something that you can do as much as every day. My cancer clients are usually doing that, or, you know, just randomly, but they have so many benefits. And when I talk to clients, you know, usually they get that weird look on their face. And I'm like, no, listen. They're really amazing. So yes, they're helping with detox, and I can talk about the details on that. Yes, they will help move things along. That's so not the point of why I ever do them. But the cool thing is they will put you into parasympathetic. It's like a sneaky little backdoor, pun intended, way to get your vagal nerve stimulated. And for me and most of my cancer clients, we tend to be like sympathetic stuck where we're like amped up all the time. And so to have something that is for detox, but then side benefit, multitasking, it also helps you calm down. Like, it's such a blessing. And if I start to like lose it, you know, mom's getting upset, I'll be like, okay, mom is going to go do a coffee enema. And my kids all know mom needs her time. And that's like my Zen place. I love my coffee enemas. And all my clients, except one who had trouble holding them, which was a separate issue, have come back on some level and been like, Katrina, I kind of like them. Is that weird? I'm like, no, it's not weird. They're very helpful that way.
I love that because I haven't talked much about those on the podcast yet. And it's something I've experimented with as well and found helpful, especially on water fast toward the end. I just feel like that's helpful to like help the body move everything that's it's detoxing while I'm not eating. And when digestion would normally be slow. And I also love that you brought up HCL. I feel like this is hugely underrated for how beneficial it can be. And it's very much sort of bioidentical. It's something our body naturally makes. And so this is not like an exogenous thing. We don't have to worry about it getting too much outside of that physiologic range, like you said, to listen to your body on. But it can be so, so helpful. You also mentioned sauna use, which again, not accessible to everyone, but if it is available, I feel like that's one thing that was, if it was a pill, we would all take it based on what the studies say about the benefits. So if it's available to you, that's an awesome one to work in. Another fact that I read recently, and I would love your take on this in the mineral balance side, but in all of the advice we've all gotten for so long to avoid salt, I have read that basically we might be depleting our stomach acid through lack of availability of those basic things like sodium and chloride. And then actually when we add salt and minerals back in and we have available chloride, our body will use much of that to create hydrochloric acid, our stomach acid. But it to me, like I keep hearing this recurring theme of minerals and how we're very often deficient in a lot of important minerals in today's world because of the soil being depleted, the food supply being depleted. So I'm curious if you personally and or if you recommend people getting minerals checked or just making sure they're getting enough minerals in general.
Yes. Oh, that was a big one. So lots of work with minerals. So to circle back around with the HCL, here's the thing. Most people are not aware of that. If your stomach acid, the pH in your stomach is not low enough, no matter what minerals you're eating, you're not going to be able to absorb them, which is super offensive. So there's this negative spiral. You need things like the chloride and the zinc and everything to make the stomach acid. But if you don't have the stomach acid, you're not going to absorb the zinc and such, which is this negative thing, which is why it's nice to intervene. But the minerals, it's huge. One of the biggest areas that I see clients have a problem with is that when they start to shift, I'm shifting them usually to a ketogenic diet. And what happens is when your blood sugar goes up, then your body secretes insulin. And the insulin, we all know, you know, you heard in high school, it tells the body to put the glucose in the cells, right? But it does a lot more. And when you have that insulin, it's also signaling the kidneys to retain the salt, to keep the sodium. So if you start going lower carb, which is, you know, for health reasons, a lot of people have issues, you know, you hear about keto flu and stuff, and a lot of that, not all of it, has to do with dumping the electrolytes because your insulin's not there to say, hey, hold on to the salt. So I am always telling my clients, please make sure you drink extra salt. Whether you know, do something like Element or you put just plain old, you know, unrefined sea salt into your water, that's up to you. Or just even salting your food a lot more, because most people have these ideas that we've been taught that, you know, less is better. You're like a more virtuous person if it's low sodium, which do it to your taste. If you want more salt, your body needs it. And then circling around, when you're talking about the infrared saunas and you're sweating, you are losing more salt because, you know, if you lick your arm, you know that it's salty and you're sweating it out and you need to have a lot more going in. So if people are doing the saunas, if they're doing low carb, like they're actually going to need that more. But some people just aren't eating enough in the first place because of a lot of guilt issues. There's so much bound up in here. And then just the hydration component, you know, if they're not hydrated, a lot of times there's a lot of issues, not only with the hydrochloric acid, dehydration is a big one there, but then, you know, you talk about, you know, saunas and sweating it out, it's going to exacerbate the whole thing. So these are all tied in together. And I love that you brought it up.
Yeah. I feel like one simple, almost free tip that I have for people is, it was a drastic difference when I started just putting a teaspoon of salt in a big cup of water, keeping it on my nightstand. And first thing in the morning, before screens, before anything, drinking that water and ideally going outside in the sunlight, which is great for the cortisol thing we talked about in the first episode. I feel like that's almost free because salt is so inexpensive. And that's made a huge difference in my energy levels. And of course, there's so much at play there with losing water while we sleep, the hydration that you mentioned. And I feel like that just that salt in the morning helps so much. So that's one people can experiment with. If you haven't tried it, it's so simple, but so helpful. On that note, any other parting tips for the listeners today, and or where can they keep learning about this topic from you?
Parting tips. I would say the biggest thing is just to re-harp on that hydration. Like you were saying, you lose so much moisture through your mouth, but a lot of people are just not taking it in the first place. They think they are. And most of my clients are very educated, very intelligent people. They've listened and done their research and stuff, but they'll come to me and they're not drinking alcohol. They're not drinking soda pop and teas and caffeine and stuff. But the thing they're doing is they're having a lot of herbal teas. And you want to be aware that most, not all, herbal teas are diuretic. So they're working against the hydration. And this is, they're coming in like, I'm taking this tea all the time and it's so good for me. And, you want to make sure that you understand that it's going to be working against you hydration wise. Well, it may have a therapeutic effect, and then balance out which is the thing you need the most. So in terms of hydration, drinking it. And then since we're talking about coffee enemas, I'm just going to go here. A lot of times, especially when I'm nursing, I will do kind of like a inverse enema where I retain it with just good pure water. And you can actually put nutrients in that. So put it in, leave it in, and let it stay there if possible, because your colon's job is to reabsorb water. So that's one of the easiest, most effective ways to rehydrate. Make sure you get that water in.
I'll put that in the show notes. That's a new tip for me too. I have not tried retention enemas.
Oh my goodness. If I didn't have that when I was nursing, I could never get enough water in. It was always like this huge struggle. My kids were voracious nursers. So yeah. And you had mentioned where to find me. My website is cancerfreedom.com. You can find me on Facebook at Nutritional Pilates, which is the name of my book. And Instagram's just my name, Katrina Foe.
And all of those will be linked in the show notes for any of you guys listening on the go. Katrina, thank you so much for being here. I learned so much from both of our episodes. It was such a joy to talk to you. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
And thanks as always to all of you for listening and sharing your most valuable resources, your time, your energy, and your attention with us today. We're both so grateful that you did. And I hope that you will join me again on the next episode of the Wellness Mama podcast. If you're enjoying these interviews, would you please take 2 minutes to leave a rating or review on iTunes for me? Doing this helps more people to find the podcast, which means even more moms and families can benefit from the information. I really appreciate your time, and thanks as always for listening.